My name is Brian Gilbreck. I am 50 years old. Today's date is 29 September 2018, and I am speaking with George Cummings, who happens to be my great uncle. We are recording this interview in Kennewick, Washington.
Yes, I'm George Cummings, and I live in Kennewick, Washington, and I am 86 years old.
And George, there's a story in the family told to me by my grandmother, your sister, Nikki, about how you joined the Army when you were 15, which now they certainly wouldn't allow it, and back then I don't think they allowed that either. So what I'd like to do is just kind of talk about that story and get the ground truth from you and all the details. So if you wouldn't mind just starting off as to what prompted you to want to join the Army at the age of 15?
Well, my sister's husband, which was Harry Gilbreck, he wanted somebody to go in the service with him. And that's what brought me to do this, and I used my sister's birth certificate because she was actually 3 years older than me, so I crossed it out with white out and put George where Marjorie Cummings was. I just whited out the Marjorie and put George. And Houston went right on through and enlisted.
So did you have to use a typewriter and just typed over the document?
I don't remember whether it was typed in or whether I wrote it in. Printed it in, I might say. I can't remember that.
Now, is it correct?
But this was in 1948. That was March of 1948.
Now, Harry knew that you weren't old enough to get in.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure.
So he was a willing accomplice.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Because he was married to my sister, then. I thought of something really kind of, be nice to be in the Army You see a few war pictures and this and that, and you try to make yourself out a hero before you really get in. But we went to, we processed through Fort Sheridan and went to Fort Knox, Kentucky, mm-hmm. where the gold was all stored at that time.
Now, Harry was with you?
Yeah, he was back. He was in the same Company B as that was the 3rd Armored Division, where we were stationed at, to take our basic there. Well, I just wasn't cut out for Army life at that time, that young. Maybe say a little homesick or something like that.
So what was it in particular that made you realize that you might have made a mistake?
The basic didn't bother me, you had to take some, it's just a difference in being able to adjust yourself to that kind of life. So I just told him I was, went in and I said, hey, I'm only 15.
And
he said if it was me, this old sergeant, he said you'd be dishonorably discharged. But he said minority section, you're under, you're getting an honorable discharge. But he said don't start your life out this way, where you're. Of course, they were talking about Korea then, and that was in 48. Nobody knew anything about having trouble. I mean, we never got much news. They didn't cover the news like they do now.
Yeah.
I think that 3rd Armored Division, that was a tank division, mm-hmm. We had to take that kind of training too. the ground.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, part of your training.
So how long were you in basic training before?
Well, I was only in 2 months and 22 days, so I didn't finish the full basic course. You know.
How long was basic back then?
You know, I was trying to think. I think it was... It might have been six, but when I went in the second time, that's when I took the 16 weeks of infantry training, you know. Because there was war going on, that made a little difference, you know. They didn't want to send you over there with no training, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, what did, were you and Harry in the same squad?
Yeah, same
platoon.
Yeah, same platoon and everything, yeah.
And so what did he say when you told
him? I know this first sergeant, he come up to us and he said, "We're going to have a party tonight." So he said, "Get your toothbrushes out." And I said, "What kind of a party with a toothbrush?" We had to GI the whole barracks with a toothbrush. And he said, "Now," he said, "you might be homesick, you might be." He said, "You've not been away from home," but he said, "I'm your mother, your dad. And if you don't like me," he said, "we're going to walk right around the barracks and settle the peace." Yeah, it kind of scary, you know. Of course, being only 15, I didn't know how to take some of that, you know. What am I getting myself in for, you know?
Did you tell any of your platoon mates that you were 15?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they know.
So they knew.
And some of them said, "Why don't you stay in?" You know, well, I said, "You can retire when you're 35. That'd be true.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. But no, I was glad to get home. And,
so was Harry supportive of your decision at first?
Well, he could still want me to stay in. And then, of course, after that, I think he got into some trouble with the service and stuff. I don't know. He had a pretty hard time of it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do you know any details about that?
Oh, gosh, not to really remember everything, but I know he was home to see my sister and stuff without a leave, you know, so that meant A-W-O-L.
Sure it is.
No question about that.
Oh, gotcha.
But,
now, what was your impression of Kentucky when you were there?
Oh, Kentucky and the bluegrass, yeah, pretty, yeah. It was right close to Louisville, Kentucky. Yeah. Yeah. It was nice. As far as the Fort Knox was, it was a nice, clean place to, you know, to be stationed.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was two places together. I can't remember. It was Louisville, and then there was another place to go in the just opposite direction from Fort Knox. Louisville, Kentucky, and then, now I remember the second time when I was stationed at Fort Riley, Kansas. I can remember Manhattan and then Junction City. That was the two that was close.
Yeah.
Manhattan was kind of a nicer town, and Junction City was a military town. That's where most of the guys took their three-day passes, you know, or overnight. They want a weekend or something, they would go in there.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, when you told the first sergeant or presented your actual birth certificate and they discharged you, what happened after that?
Oh, that was, you know, it just showed that I was discharged under minority, honorable discharge, and I still got my discharge at some point.
Well, did they just give you a one-way bus ticket back to Minnesota, or what?
You know, I think they did, yeah. I think they did furnish the transportation for back to, yeah.
And then when you got back to Minnesota, what did you do?
Went to work in a creamery and 60 cents an hour.
What job did you do there?
Well, it was, they was making powdered milk, and their barrels would weigh about 700 pounds. You'd put a stencil and all that stuff, and then you have to, they had liner inside the big barrel, and the powder milk, and then you'd shake it so it would settle down, and when, once it was full, you'd put it and put the lid on it, and stencil it and everything, and you'd roll them, and then they had like a truck deal, you know, a hand truck. You could take them over, and they load them on a truck. That was quite a job, you know, really, for 60 cents an hour.
And how long did you do that?
Oh, gosh, I worked there probably, well, in them days, 3-4 months was a long time, you know. It's probably only that, 3-4 months.
Now, did you tell your mother or father that you had, were going to enlist?
Oh, yes, they knew, they knew.
So they knew you also forged the
first name? Yeah, well, sure, sure. They didn't know. They thought it was all right. I don't know. It, I afterwards should have never done it, you know. Never. Never think of them things at the time.
Yeah, when you had all, you know, the best and honorable intentions.
Yeah, because he had a little farm, and I could have been a lot more helpful to parents and stuff, which made me feel bad, because my dad was getting old. I was already 15, and, well, he had to be like 65 or more.
And how long did you work at the creamery?
Oh, I'd say probably between 3 and 4 months, yeah.
And then what did you do after that?
Well, then, odd jobs. Railroad, I worked well on an extra gang. We went out and took in the harvest in North Dakota, shock grain. Because I just, you know, Minnesota didn't have the farm work like North Dakota had. I mean, the wheat fields and stuff. So I found more work in North Dakota and South Dakota. Yeah. And then I followed a couple of the dams. I worked on the Garrison Dam, and I worked on the Grand Coulee Dam. And we put in bases for the generators that they put in after the dam was built. They put in 2 generators, on the, so we made the base for them, you know, concrete. I was actually with a concrete crew. And come to think about it, my foreman at that concrete crew was Carl Gilbrick.
Who's that?
That's your dad. Not your dad, but your his dad's brother.
No kidding.
Yes, Carl, nice guy. Just now, he was by a different marriage. He had this Carl before he married Stella, which was, and then he had Stella and Joy. That was his sister's name. So Harry and Joy was Stella's and Carl's. Not Carl's, but his name was Ed Gilbrick. And they were his, you know, her and Ed's real kids. And Carl was, by a previous marriage, Ed was married to somebody before he married Stella.
Gotcha.
They moved up to Kingsdale, Minnesota. They had a place. We'd go deer hunting up there, you know. Quite a drive up there, northern part. And a lot of snow, and of course, hunting season. They had a big tent set up for us. My dad would go up there with my dad, Bert. He liked on. He got a nice big buck the 1 year up there.
Yeah.
He was all excited over it. Yeah.
So out of curiosity, how did you find the job? You know, like today people get on the
There was always jobs out there if you wanted to work, you know. There was always something to do.
Yeah, how did you find
He didn't make a lot of money, though. Of course, the money wasn't. You never had a good paying job, you know. Jobs are just what they call almost now the minimal wage or whatever, you know. There was different jobs. We stopped in Bozeman, Montana, and we got a job with a guy running a sawmill, and we worked there for a couple of weeks and left. We went to look for one job in, I can't remember, another little town. But this guy said, yeah, I can use you guys. But he said, you're only going to stay about a week and then take off. So he said, I really don't want to fool with you.
Now, when you say
and we looked at each other. That was two friends that I had, one of the Olson boys, Chuck Olson, and Bub Allgaier was the other one's name. They lived in Rock Creek, where Chuck lived, and, well, they both lived in Rock Creek, yeah. And we'd take off, and we'd stop and work here, and then take off and work some more.
So did you have, like, a plan in life, or were you
just... No, no plan, no. Just on the road again, you know. Yeah, that was quite a deal. Yeah.
So you'd work for a couple weeks or so, make enough money to move on?
Move on, yeah. We ended up in a park in Lind, Washington. Now, right from here, that's about 60 miles towards Spokane. They call it the Big Bend country, a lot of wheat harvesting and stuff. So there was a road, town park in Lynn there, and we laid down on the grass there, and we had $1.44 between the three of us. Gas gauge was almost close to empty. What are we gonna do, you know? The guy pulled up and said, are you guys looking for work? And I said, gosh, you know, is that God speaking or what is that? So I said, yeah, we are. He said, well, I can use some guys for haying right now. And he said, the harvest will be starting up in a couple of weeks. He said, I'll pay you guys $25 a day driving wheat trucks. Wow, we never heard of that much money, you know.
$25 a day.
Yeah, a day, yeah.
I mean, when you think about the creamery,
$0.60 an hour, and then $25, that's something. So anyway, he said, I'll feed good. And he said, we got a place for you to stay. Guys want to come, I'll take all three. Yeah. So we drove out there, and then we hayed. I mean, hauled hay in, and they baled hay, and we handled the bales and stacked it and everything. And so then we stayed there for the harvest. He kept two of us on there, and the other guy got a job to another rancher a little bit further because he only needed two. So I and Chuck stayed there and drove trucks. We'd go to the combine and get the grain and then haul it up to the elevator and dump it. And $25 a day. Yeah.
What did you do with all that money?
Oh, man. We had a stake. I mean, we thought we could go back and live for years, you know, Minnesota. You know, if you had a couple $100, that was a lot of money, you know.
Yeah.
That was a stake. That was almost like you're staying at home and everything.
So did you, like, put that money in a bank? Or
no.
What did you do with it?
No. Just spend it. Come easy, go easy.
It's kind of hard to spend $25 a day.
Yeah,
in
them
days.
Yeah, yeah.
You couldn't eat that.
Well, I remember when a movie was 11 cents, a bag of popcorn was 5, so it cost you all of 16 cents to go to a movie and have popcorn, you know.
Yeah.
So that was quite a, you know, treat. They didn't have, like, too many TVs out then. TV started getting more popular in 48, but all they had Ku Klux Klan and Ollie, and there was not much on them. All black and white, there was nothing on them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, how long did you guys work in Lind, Washington?
Well, through the whole harvest, we stayed right to the end. Then he gave us a bonus. I can't remember how much it was, but it was like a couple dollars a day extra.
that didn't make you just want to stay there and wait?
Well, we couldn't stay, you know, it wouldn't have been enough for us to do. To see, they didn't have no, it wasn't like a dairy farm or anything. They didn't have a lot of cattle or anything, you know.
Did you consider, like, wanting to do that again for the next
time? Well, we were thinking about it, yeah, and then we never did go back, you know.
And where did you go after that?
Well, I'll tell you, I think it was too long after that. That was probably in the late, either late 40s or early 50s that we worked in Lynn. So I went in the service again in 52.
Yeah, that was a big pay cut.
Yeah, yeah. Volunteered induction.
Yeah.
That's what I think they called it. You volunteered the draft, you know. You went into the service that way.
So we talked about that yesterday.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that you discharged out in Fort Lewis in Washington, and then you got a job with Carrie's father.
Yeah, in the woods.
And what, can you kind of explain what you were doing there?
Well, you'd done everything because it was called a gibbo logger, and they did all the rigging up, rigging the tree up, notching the guy lines, spiking them down, doing everything, getting all set up. The only thing we didn't do is fall the timber. They had regular timber fallers that come in and fell the trees and cut them into log links, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we had to get set up to log them, and they had what they call a head loader and a second loader, and they would load the logs onto the truck, and the truck would haul them off to the mills or wherever they were going. But we would set chokers and hang down from what they call a butt rigging, and you'd have three sets of chokers. You could haul three logs in a time. We had a 200 Washington yarder with a big triple drum, I think, but it would have a haul back and a main line, and we'd send a turn down. Sometimes we'd log downhill, we'd use a tail tree, and if we was logging uphill, you'd just have the one spar tree, but you had to put guy lines on it and everything, keep it from, you know, put a lot of strain on that spar tree,
because
you had your block up in there then, and then you had your tail blocks and all that stuff. You had to be careful because you never wanted to get in the bite of a line because of a block bust or something. That line had cut you right in half, you know. Because you got all the steel pulling on it and strain on it. That's happened to a lot of different loggers. Dangerous work.
Yeah, do you remember any accidents on your work?
I remember the first day I went to work. It was a bad accident, right? All of a sudden, I heard a bunch of whistles going into the, the whistle. They had what they call a whistleblower, and he'd send in your signals. Like, if you're ready to send your turn in, you'd let out one holler, and he'd go ahead with it.
Mm-hmm.
And the yard engineer would get the message up there, and he'd start yarding it in. So anyway, here come a whole bunch of whistles, and I said, what the hell? He said, there's something wrong. He said, we've got to go up. The landing, the loader, and he was the head loader, I think, was on the truck talking to the guy. He was still in the cab of the truck. Usually they got out until it was loaded. But he was talking to him, and the guy running the loading machine had the grapple, had a hold of the log, and swung it around, and it killed him, and he was dead. That was the first day, and I said, I don't know about this, you know, have somebody get killed on the very first day you're working. But that's what happened.
And I mean, you didn't have any experience.
No, I was greenhorn. They said, one old logger told me that I was working on the rigging crew. He said, you got to be careful of the greenhorn and the one that's been here a long time, that knows too much. You know, and I, that getting a bite like that, you're nothing's going to happen, you know. They were so sure of themselves, but never, you know. So he said two people you had to watch out for was the greenhorn and the guy who'd been there a long time, you know.
Now, how long did it take before you felt like you were fully trained?
Oh, it seemed like after 3 months I was a full-fledged logger, you know. I could, then you got in good shape, you know, because you're climbing the hills and packing heavy blocks, packing straps, doing this, doing that, swinging mauls to spike put the spikes in the stumps and stuff for your guy lines. Mm-hmm. I was doing work, hard work all the time.
Now, what was the pay for that job?
You know, I think we were getting, $2.25 an hour. $2.25, which wasn't much money. $18 a day. But it was a lot of money for the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know. I can remember my dad telling me he worked for 50 cents a day. And my wife's dad worked the same, 50 cents a day. That's all they got. That was probably back in the late 30s and early 40s, you know. See, I was working in modern times in the 50s, you know.
Right.
56, 55, actually.
So did you buy a house in Washington?
Well, yeah, our first house was a small 28-foot trailer. And it was an old one. We took it up to Forks, where I was working there. And we would work hoot owl, what they call hoot owl. You had to get in and get out of there before they shut you down for fire control. You know, the humidity getting down so low, they'd kick you out of the woods. You couldn't, because the cables and stuff could start a fire. So, but we'd work, go to work at 3 in the morning. And we'd have to be out of there by, you know, roughly noon, you know.
But it's dark. How do you see when you're
going? Well, you can see pretty good. You'd be surprised. Your eyes get used to the, it's not really like pitch dark. It's like light. First time, yeah. 4 or 5 o'clock almost daylight.
So you lived in a trailer.
Yeah.
And how did you, was there like a campground, or where do you park a trailer?
It's in a trailer park, up at Fork. Yeah. I can't remember, it wasn't too much rent.
Yeah.
$25 a month, I think, to park.
So when did you buy your first house?
First house was bought in, Terry, can you remember when we bought our first place? That was from Helen Davis at the 12 lots up there on Elm Street. Yeah, we bought that, and I thought, gee, we're never going to get out of debt. The house was $5,000, and I thought, and we put $500 down on it, and our payments was $75 a month or something. I thought, you know, we're never going to live long enough to pay for that. But, you know, it's just the way times are.
Right.
Yeah. Now it's all, you know. So I tell Carrie, we got a nice house. Everything's paid for, nothing. We don't owe a dime on furniture, on the cars, anything, you know. And I said, we got a lot to be thankful for.
Yeah.
Because you think back at what you had to go through to get where you are, you know.
Now, how long did you do that logging job?
I think I worked about 3 years. Yeah. So I think our first house was bought in 57, was it? Had to be right around 57.
And then what did you do as your next career?
Next career, I went to work in the mill, warehouse and mill, on the green chain. And a guy said, nobody knows what work is until they work on a green chain. They have no idea what work is. And as told by many people, and I agree with it, that is one of the hardest jobs. They cut the lumber, and they're cutting like all kinds of different sized lumber, you put them, you pull them off, you're tangled up, you're working, I mean, you're working. And nobody's ever knows what work is until they were in. Dean, a fish counter down at McNary, he said his dad told him the same thing. He said, nobody knows what work is until they worked on a green ship.
So did all the, like, new employees start there?
Most of them, yeah. Herb went, he lasted 1 week, wasn't it? Yeah. I went over and helped him. He was over and he was piled up with lumber and everything. And I went over and said, holy Christ, he said, huh? it was one heck of a job, you know. But I worked out green chain for 10 years. Yes, 10 years.
Sounds like you were a glutton for punishment.
Glutton for, but I loved to work. You know, and the one assistant foreman, he said to me, he said, George, these are exact words he said. Mike Kritis was his name. And he said, if I had anything to do with it, you'd be the highest paid one here in the mill. He said, we'd been piled up, and he said, you get this thing going in half an hour.
The
chain. Who was that?
Dolores, my friend.
Yeah.
Dolores, her dad.
Oh, that was her dad, Mike Kritis?
Yeah.
I'll be darned. Yeah. Yeah, he was a nice guy. Our main foreman was August Wilson, you know. Mm-hmm. Or spent some fun in the mill. We made, you know, different ones, named them different.
And
this Neil, he looked like Jack Elam. You know, you've seen that movie actor, One Eye Crossing, and just really. So this Neil, he looked the same way. And this chain checker, he used to get mad at that Neil because he'd be looking around, missing lumber and everything. And he said, Neil, he said, you got to go to the hospital at 2:00. He looked at her, what for? What for? He said, to pick up your brain. He said, it's going to be ready. Everybody started laughing, you know. This guy called Hank Grinke, he would laugh, and he wouldn't laugh loud. He would just bend over, and his face would turn red, and tears would come out of his eyes. And he got the biggest charge out of different things that happened, you know. Walt Rosenthal, they called him Frankenstein. He fell down on the dock one day, did a belly flop. He had a couple of drinks too many, I think, if you could smell. And anyway, teeth flew out. So I grabbed a piece of lath out of the bin and started like a sword, you know. He lay there and rolled his eyes and didn't have no teeth. Of course, Hank, he was laughing just on us. Well, it came out in the paper that Walter Rosenthal fell down the house of the old repute. It was a cat house, anyway. He fell down the stairs, got all scratched up. So anyway, he came to work and told the guys working there that he fell out of a Jeep or something, backing up. He fell out of the Jeep. And he was all scratched up, and come to find out, he was the one that fell down the steps.
And it was in the paper?
It was in the paper, yeah. Actually, it had just a little paper, the Raymond Herald, it was called. And that was right the headline, so. Walter Rosenthal, yeah. He looked at me. He was about 6'8", tall. And he kind of shuffled when he walked. That's why they started calling him Frankenstein, because he was working next to a guy that looked like the Wolfman. He had bushy hair, and he was pulling up bib overalls. He'd be walking along with us, and all of those and all. They got the name of, he looked like Frankenstein. That's when Frankenstein, the Wolfman, all of them shows were coming out, you know. And, he looked... It was a fun place, really.
Now, how long did you work in total?
20-some years.
Oh. And then after that, count fish?
No, after that, I sold ice cream.
Oh, yeah.
cream for, I don't know, we sold ice cream for 6 years, I mean. More than six, maybe, it might have been. I was trying to think. Say, I left the mill in 78. We came to Pasco and bought a house. And actually assumed a mortgage. And the house is only like $46,000. And assumption was $26,000. So I give them $20,000 down and we took over. And we stayed there for 20 years. That was, I think I sold ice cream probably for 7 or 8. And I took the Fish Mountain job. I took the Fish Mountain job in 97. Yeah, that was in 97 I took the job. And I stayed there until 2015.
How long did I?
You worked at Iowa Beef, Mom, not at the dam, no.
What is Iowa Beef?
That was just down further. Down, if you're going toward Walla Walla, it's down about another 15 miles, I'd say. It's a big slaughterhouse.
Oh.
Yeah. Now it's called Tyson. Well, they still do the slaughter of the beef. They went through 1,000 head an hour.
That's a pretty big operation.
So, yeah, it's a big operation. I was in material handling, and that was considered, we would load trucks, pick the boxes, pick the orders, you know, so many boxes of chucks and so many boxes of hamburgers to get a whole order. And then the loaders would load it in the trucks.
So you worked at that place also?
Yeah, I worked at Iowa Beef for, oh gosh. That's before I really started to. I worked for Iowa Beef before we started selling ice cream, wasn't it? Yeah, that was before.
So
that was between 78 and 83, I think, I worked at Iowa Beef.
So, it seems like an interesting transition between working at, say, a slaughterhouse to selling ice cream. How did that idea come into your
mind? Well, Shauna's husband, they come over from Iran, and he and his brothers, they had a big ice cream plant, and they got into this selling ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
So it gave me the idea. I got a little Volkswagen van that I started with, put a freezer in the back, and I'd stop and get out and everything. Then finally we got these U.S. mail trucks that they actually, and they looked just like the ones, or they were older, they were in the early 70s. I bought four of them. I think I paid, what was it, about $800 a piece I got them for. They were surplus. I mean, I had a good kid that worked, and he was a good mechanic, and he kept them up, you know, kept them tuned up, and if something go wrong, he could fix it just like that, you know, brakes and everything else. So that was a big help. But we'd go out and make $100 a day, clear, you know. Or more. I think there are days that we made a couple $100. We made our own scoops, so we sold them. You would buy a 5 gallon of ice cream for $5, you know. You could make, oh gosh, how many? We could make 200 scoops out of that. We'd make $100 for spending 18.
Yeah.
It's a pretty good profit on your money. Of course, there's work involved, you know. No, I mean, I'm talking about the drivers. We had Kurt, and he was a mechanic, and then Jerry, and then his friend Dan, he worked too. And then we had that, what's that other guy? Not Farnsworth, what's his name? Gosh.
Actually, you've done quite well, in my opinion.
Well, I can remember, you know.
So you have four trucks running.
Yeah.
And that $100 a day was just each
truck?
Oh,
no, each truck, yeah.
Yeah,
wow. Yeah. Yeah, I paid him at that time minimum wage of $7 an hour, and that's what I gave the driver. He was happy with it, you know. Because it wasn't hard work. Barnes was his name. Barnes. And he had long red hair and a ponytail. And he kind of forget stuff, you know, like you'd have to unplug from the freezer, because when you back your truck in there, you'd plug in to your freezer and the truck would be running, you know. And sometimes he'd forget to unplug and he'd take off and he had 25 feet of drag along behind after running, catching up. Sometimes he'd call, he said, the truck won't start. I'd go there and turn the battery cable and tighten a little bit, fire right up, you know. I said, gee, where's Barnes? I said, check them batteries, you know. And he said, I didn't know. Kind of a hippie, you know. He was with them were the days of the hippies, you know. So, yeah, he was a funny one, but a nice guy. He was really a good guy. But he, You could write a story about some of them guys. Can you imagine telling a story about the bear that works in the woods?
Oh my God.
The guy, they called him Bear. Cause he looked like a bear, you know. Him and Terry's dad would, he'd holler up. He said, it's going to be a nice day tomorrow. I see the moon, because he'd lose his hat, you know, swing some cable around and knock his hat off and go clear to the ground. And a lot of people said he would climb down from the tree to get that hat on. He didn't want it. He was ashamed of his bald head. Really self-conscious over it, you know. But the bear is the only one that could, he thought the bear was funny, I guess. And the only one that could dare say anything about it. That was kind of funny. Yeah.
Well, there's some hard men, I'm sure.
And he'd sing. You see the bear going ahead of him up the hill from the landing, you know, and was just getting ready to start work. And he had sang, the bear went over the mountain, the bear went over the mountain, the bear went over the mountain to see what he could see. And then he'd start laughing, you know. The bear couldn't take any. He'd a couple times, and then the bear would turn around and said, and what did he see? He saw a bald-headed old black folk. Oh, no, no, no. Then he'd laugh. Her dad had the funniest laugh anyway. He'd just get so tickled over stuff and just, he just shakes and he laughs hard. That's a picture of him now, that 50th anniversary.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He's a big guy.
Yeah.
All right.
End of the story.